This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, January 21st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. 2 years ago, the city of Flint, Michigan, began getting its water from the Flint River. There were immediate reports of contamination, but authorities weren't really seriously called to account until now. This past weekend, President Obama declared a state of emergency in the city. He was in Detroit on Wednesday.
If I was a parent up there, I would be beside myself that my kids' health could be at risk. It is a reminder of why you can't shortchange basic services that we provide to our people and that we together provide as a government to make sure that public health and safety is preserved.
Evan Osnos joins me to discuss the politics of the disaster. So, Evan, people and businesses, for that matter, in Flint have been complaining about the river water from the beginning. A GM plant noticed that it was corroding car parts, and that's just one example. Why was this considered an acceptable water source, and why was the governor, Rick Snyder, so reluctant to do anything about it? His slogan, as I hear, is relentless positive action.
Yeah, there was a real disconnect between what was going on the ground and what the politicians wanted to be happening. The decision to change the water source in Flint was, like so much in that city, driven by a desperate attempt to save money. You know, the place has been operating at huge deficits for years, and Rick Snyder, when he came into office, was promoting a new kind of austerity. He's a CPA by training, and he liked to say that he was going to be the token CPA in American government, that he was going to finally get things under control. And the decision in 2014 to change the water source was ultimately approved by an emergency manager. That's somebody who's appointed by the state rather than elected by the local people in Flint. And this has become a huge point of contention, because what they say is that had this been an elected official, had Flint essentially been allowed to govern its own affairs, then there would have been the normal democratic interplay where people would have been able to register their complaints, the system would have heeded those complaints, and up it would go, and eventually something would get done. But what you see, and this is only becoming clearer now that the governor has under enormous pressure released his emails over the last couple of years, you've begun to see that the governor's office was hearing about these complaints, but a culture of denial in effect had set in where all of the communication internally was, look, this is just being overplayed. And I think on some level there was a belief that the governor's office knew better and that the state was able to make decisions that Flint wasn't able to make for themselves, and that have turned out to be wrong.
But what about the mayor?
The mayor has been pretty blunt about the fact that she thinks that they were treated in a way that, as she puts it, a rich white suburb wouldn't have been treated. That, in effect, her powers were circumscribed because of the role of the emergency manager. And she thinks Flint's concerns were not taken seriously because it is a city that has struggled for so long.
The population of Flint is disproportionately poor and more than 50% African American. And there's enough of a history of eco-disasters in poor and minority communities that there's actually a name for them, environmental racism. But is it racism?
We have an interesting piece this week on NewYorker.com by Van Newkirk. His story, I thought, does this really important thing, which is it reminds us of a study that was first done in the 80s and then was reprised 20 years later in 2007, which looked at this phenomenon known as environmental racism and says, well, where are hazardous waste sites in the United States? Where are the sewage plants, the incinerators, the steel mills, things like that? And what they found was that, in fact, if you controlled for elements like geography and income, that the single strongest correlation was with race. So there is something there. I mean, at the time the study was first done, three of the country's five largest hazardous waste landfills were either in black or Hispanic communities. And for years you'd heard complaints about this, but there wasn't much hard data to support it. When they went back in 2007 and looked again at the situation, it really wasn't any better. Most of the people living within 2 miles of a hazardous waste facility in the U.S. are people of color. You know, civil rights groups have complained about this for years, and they have complained specifically about the civil rights office at the EPA, saying that it doesn't do enough. And there had been a number of big cases, Baton Rouge, Syracuse, other places. But over its 22-year history, the Civil Rights Office has never made a formal finding that one of these cases actually violates the Civil Rights Act. And that's the thing that frustrates the activists. They say there is law here, there are ways to punish bad decisions, but it's just not being used.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
In April 2014, just when the switch in Flint was being implemented, you wrote a piece for the magazine about pollution in West Virginia. Was that a comparable problem?
Yeah, there was an interesting parallel here. I mean, Charleston, West Virginia, which I was writing about, is different than Flint. But you remember a couple of years ago that there was big news out of West Virginia because chemicals had leaked into the river that runs right through the state capital. It happened to be catastrophically about a mile away from the biggest water treatment plant in the state. It was one of the most serious water contamination events in American history, but it was also, and I think this is important, it was the fifth industrial accident in just 8 years in West Virginia. So something was going wrong. And when you went back and looked at all of the factors that contributed, you saw this very clear pattern, which was that there was this confluence of political factors, a combination of lobbying by powerful coal and chemical companies, campaign finance, and ideology. And this is, in some sense, the ideology that also took hold in Michigan, which is the sense that there is a generation of elected officials who believe that the old way of doing business, the old way of crafting environmental regulations, the old sort of forms of enforcement, no longer apply. And in West Virginia, they'd been systematically scaled back. And so this very vulnerable population, West Virginia, on a whole variety of measures, is one of the most disadvantaged places in the country. But, you know, over the course of the last 5 years, the state had recorded something like 25,000 violations of the Clean Water Act and had never once issued a fine. And so what you're seeing is that there are these places in which people feel as if they're not just being harmed by the industries which they depend on ultimately for their livelihood, but really, in many cases, there have been political choices that have been made that leave them more vulnerable than they should be.
Has the problem been corrected in West Virginia?
To some degree. I mean, people have gone to jail. That was a case that was so spectacular that it had to be addressed. But I was talking to somebody yesterday in West Virginia, and she was saying that these days people have gone back to drinking the water. The water is now safe. But they worry. I mean, they worry, one, about the long-term effects of that exposure that they had, but they really also worry about whether the political culture that created it leaves them at risk for similar kinds of problems in the future, because a lot of the underlying issues that we were writing about, those haven't been fixed, and there's sort of much deeper problems at work.
Over five decades ago, Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, which appeared first as a piece in this magazine. It led to the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and various other environmental protections. We have the Environmental Protection Agency and state and local agencies to regulate against this kind of thing. Did any of those agencies come into play as this was unfolding in Flint?
They did. It's now clear that the EPA didn't do enough when it could have. What I think is really quite striking when you go back and look at it, and I was thinking about this yesterday about Silent Spring and the legacy of it, is that when you go back and look at what happened, when Rachel Carson published that book and the excerpt in The New Yorker, she was attacked. It was very personal. People called her hysterical. Some people said she was a communist sympathizer who was working for the Soviets, something like that. And there are parallels there to the way that people in Flint were regarded. If you look at the email communication going on in the state government, there is often a reflexive tendency to say, well, if you're crying foul about something which is such a basic part of our lives, well, something must be wrong with you. It can't be that we are, in fact, all living surrounded by these kinds of problems. And she was right. But it's worth pointing out that in the years since Rachel Carson published her book, and then it did contribute to the creation of a regulatory system that was appropriate, the regulatory system really hasn't kept up. One of the things you hear a lot about when you talk to activists around this is that the biggest law around chemical safety, which is known as TSCA, that was passed in 1976, and it hasn't been updated substantially since then. Congress is working on new legislation, but there are a lot of interests that want to try to maintain the way that law is today, and therefore it really hasn't gone very far. So it's actually kind of amazing how much the same dynamics which surrounded Silent Spring 50 years ago, I think, are still operative today.
And some of the same issues about the interests of industry taking precedence. It was an awkward moment for the president, who was in Detroit to talk about the revitalization of the American car industry since the federal rescue in 2008. But then you've got Flint almost next door.
And this contrast was really remarkable. You can't argue with the fact that between mid-2009, when the auto bailout went into effect, and today, the number of manufacturing jobs has grown by something like 40%. There are also a large number of jobs created in dealerships, auto parts, stores, things like that. And the impact in Michigan is important. You know, one in every five jobs in that state is tied to the auto industry. But what you see is, and this I think is a microcosm of the problem that we're confronting nationally, which is that you have these radical differences between places that are, in this case, I mean, really side by side. Detroit is no wonderland by any means. The downtown, the midtown Detroit are beginning to improve, but the schools are in terrible shape. And the poverty, which has been so widespread, and also the failure of the schools, has meant that the workforce is really not prepared today to move into the kinds of middle-class jobs that it will need to really recover. But it is interesting to look at how, if you're trying to understand what's going on in our national politics at the moment, how somebody like a Donald Trump or a Bernie Sanders is able to galvanize all of this interest and energy, it's because there are large parts of the country that feel as if they are simply left out of the mainstream of American politics. They don't feel that they're being served. And there are a lot of people, whether they're in Flint or elsewhere, they look at what goes on and they say, well, the president may be in Detroit celebrating the auto bailout, but he's not in Flint talking about something that is, for those people, an absolutely basic element of their lives.
So that raises a really interesting question about the presidential campaign. Which party is better positioned to take advantage of this? And will it become an issue in the general campaign?
I think it's hard to know now, though Rick Snyder, who is a Republican, has been a very prominent figure. He was swept into office along with Scott Walker, and he represented this very tough austerity-first approach, and that is now not looking as good as it was a few years ago. I think it's early to know whether, in fact, it will have an impact on the race.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Evan Osnos is a New Yorker staff writer based in Washington and the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. This is The Political Scene. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.
You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes Store. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available at audible.com.